FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for Season 10, Episode 26, Laura Nyreiter on Juvenile False Confessions. As you guys heard in this week's episode, I don't know if you all heard it, because I know that there's a percentage of you that had already heard this episode on True Crime Binge. But as I said in the intro, that we can tell from the analytics that only a small percentage of this audience had listened to that episode. Thought it was a good one. I thought it was relevant. Also, it wasn't the plan, as I mentioned. My plan was to do a full episode on the wallet. And as I reached the end of my research on the wallet on Thursday and I was writing, realized there was definitely not enough there to do a full episode. So I thought we'd give you that extra content. I thought it was relevant, good information. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Joined in the studio today by Zach and Mike. And Mike's got a list of questions from you. And I know Zach's got some stuff to say, too. So after a quick break, we'll get right into it.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Ford Ranger, a vehicle for all terrains and every passion. It's a workmate, a playmate, and to its drivers, a soulmate. So how do you improve the Ford Ranger? You go all in. The all-new Ford Ranger, the UK's best-selling pickup. Now available with rear bumper steps, tailgate workbench, and enlarged load box that can fit a Euro pallet. Go break it in. Search all-new Ford Ranger. Ford Pro. Driving productivity. According to SMMT data, features may be optional extras with additional cost.
All right, before we get into listener questions, I know, Zach, you said you had some thoughts on the episode, so we'll hit those first, and then we'll get into the listener stuff.
I kind of want to talk about the wallet for a minute. I know that it was a very small segment. Uh-huh. I know there's been some discussion on it. But the question I have is, where did the idea of the couch location come from? I find it strange. To me, obviously, they don't know where it came from. Keith says he finds it sitting on the counter.
Right.
So they just make up the idea of a couch. But that couch had to come from somewhere. Did Keith say there was a couch? Did Cobb say it was the couch? Was there a couch there still? Why would there be a couch there if they're really like painting and doing all this stuff?
Yeah, I don't. So we know that Eva had left some furniture.
Okay.
When she moved out. But I would think that they would, just from my days of working in an apartment complex, typically, we would do that clean out. The painting was the last thing.
That's what I would assume, too, is everything that would have been in there would have been gone by the time they were doing the painting to get it ready for the next tenant.
Right. I would assume that. So I don't know. But we never have Keith saying anything about a couch. We only have, but the whole thing is, what I found is that it was just a game of, it could have been a game of telephone. It could have been a game of, I keep saying a game, but it could have just been some assumptions made. Also, remember when Cobb writes that report, he's doing some serious CYA. I mean, he's trying to cover his ass big time. You remember when we first covered it, we put in there that, I had kept this evidence in my file until I turned it over to the, and then, under cross-examine, like, what, your file was a bag in your car,
Yeah.
So his whole report is bullshit. And that's where, and that report was written months later. It was written at the time when it was finally realized he still had it and had to be turned over to the homicide office. There's just, and that's the kind of thing, like, I wanted to get more information, but there's nothing there. I don't know how to correct that. I've reached out to Cobb without response. I've reached out to Truesdale in like 10 different ways and no response. I've called his business, his house, his emails, and haven't been able to get a response to him. And I know that
So it sounds like Truesdale doesn't want anything to do with you or to talk about it.
Right. Yeah. I think that Jennifer's attorneys have spoken to him, but I don't know what the details of that were, but it was I don't know that it was super productive. And that's where I got is like, where else I can't go anywhere else with this. So all I can gather is Truesdale says, hey, I found this wallet. It was just left in the apartment. And remember, Keith just found it on the counter. Obviously, it wasn't on the counter before. And so maybe Keith said, I don't know where it came. Maybe it was behind a couch or something. Or, you know, he obviously didn't say the fridge. He didn't know it was the fridge. Mm-hmm. But it could have been something as simple as that. He could have been, you know, Keith could have said something along the lines of, I don't know, maybe it was behind a couch or behind some furniture or something. And then 3 months later, when Cobb is trying to recall this and cover his ass, he's like, oh, yeah, it was found behind the couch because that's the way he remembers it. Maybe it was just an assumption on his part. But what I hadn't realized really before that I know now after going through this is that we know that nobody talked to Urbano Medrano at that point. So no one actually knew where it came from. The only thing they knew was that it was found on the counter.
You know, you brought up Urbano, and I think that's – it's clear, too, that it was found behind the fridge, in my opinion.
Right.
Because that's not – if it was found behind a couch, you may forget. You know what I mean? If they ask, where'd you find this wallet 6 months ago or whatever it was? Well, I don't remember where I found the wallet, but it seems like it'd be pretty evident if it was if you found something behind a fridge, that seems weird. Seems like something you'd remember.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was, from the sounds of Alan's report, he was very clear about it when he called up. He didn't speak English. He had to have his daughter translate. But she said that it was pretty clear that it was tucked in the coils behind the fridge. And that was the first time we hear from Urbano was when he talks to Detective Alan. And that's at least what Alan writes in his report, is that it was tucked into the coils. And then we finally get his own words when he testifies. And again, he's very clear that it was tucked into the coils behind the fridge. So it seems like that's where it's at. Where Cobb came up with behind the couch, there's just, I know there's listeners that are just, you know, we need to dig further. There's nowhere for me to go. There's no way for me to find out that answer. You know, Cobb's not talking. And if he was, I'm sure he's not going to say, oh, well, I lied about that. And it was actually here. You know, being 25 years later, I would expect to get, I don't remember. It's probably, you know, for him, mm-hmm. his entirety of his involvement in this case was that he got handed a wallet. I don't know how much memory of that he would have.
And another thing I thought about, and I think we have a listener question about it, but is still that length of time of that apartment sitting there empty still bothers me.
Yeah.
I do not understand that one bit. I understand if it's Catalina's apartment, but I do not understand why Eva's apartment would sit there that long.
I don't either. I think a lot of it has to do, you know, there's so many unknown variables, and that's another thing. Listeners want me to get all this information about the apartments, and I don't have rights to that information. I can't get it. I have been to the office. I have spoken to a manager. I've given my card. I've told them, you know, that I'd like to talk to them to get information, and they won't give me anything. So I don't have that information. I don't know if they even would still have it because, you know, apartment complexes like that tend to change management a lot. You know, it'll be the Green Arbor apartment complex forever, but it could be completely different companies over 25 years that actually own and operate and manage the complex. But, you know, it could have been the economy at the time. Maybe they had a ton of vacant apartments. You know, we definitely, the apartments I worked at in Colorado, we definitely had times where we, you know, at any given time, we'd have 25, 30 empty apartments that, you know, our leasing agents were trying to rent, but there just wasn't enough people to rent them. So it could have just been coincidence, and it could have been, you know, because that was the building where the murder happened, they had just, you know, put that down on the priority, or said it could just been a normal operating procedures doing business. If they didn't have, you know, it's not like now, at least in our area, you know, the apartment complexes around us have 2-year waiting lists because the way the housing market is. But, you know, if it's at a time when, you know, they're trying to fill units and it just sometimes takes months to do it, it could be as simple as that.
All right, guys, let's jump into these questions. Our first one's from Lauren. Have you talked to Laura about helping with one of her cases in the future?
I haven't. I mean, that would be kind of presumptuous of me to tell her that I need to help her with her case. But yeah, I would certainly love to. But I mean, I don't know why she would use me unless she needed a case fully investigated and wanted the power of the audience and the crowdsourcing element to an investigation. But, you know, typically it's me looking for an expert, which would be her, to look into these cases, not the other way around. But no, she hasn't asked me to help her with any of her cases. She also, it should be noted, she didn't know who I was. I mean,
clearly, she had no clue who you were.
Yeah.
And I could tell that from the interview myself.
Yeah, there was definitely some time she doesn't know who I've met her a couple times, but she doesn't know anything about me. Jason does. Jason Flom, you know, when I had him on True Crime Bench, he's listened to the podcast, is familiar with our work and knew who I was.
yeah, I had a chuckle when she was bringing up the West Memphis 3 and explaining the West Memphis 3.
Yeah, yeah. Laura gave me a little taste of humble pie. Let me know that she has no idea who I am.
That's like, you know, the second time recently that's happened to you. Yeah. Derek Levasseur got you with that as well.
Yeah, on the live True Crime Binge.
It was good. Good times.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to that episode of True Crime Binge, it was a live episode, and the guest told me that he thinks that he would love to see a podcaster like me get a TV show, and went into real depth about how it would be good for me to have a TV show sometime. You have to listen to it. It's pretty funny.
It was a hearty chuckle.
All right, this one's from Sarah. Is there any way to find out who was paying the rent on Eva's apartment between November and June, or if there were other units empty during the same time frame? That's a long time for an apartment to be sitting empty unless there's a reason for it to be empty. It makes sense that renting Catalina's apartment might be problematic, but Eva's?
Yeah, like we just said, Zach, we kind of covered this. But as far as who was paying the rent, I don't think anybody was. You know, according to the leasing agents that testified at trial, Eva gave a notice that she wanted to vacate on the 31st, and then she had everything out by, I think, Monday the 3rd. My assumption now that was not the full term of, I believe she had a year-long lease. So, but my assumption would be, and it's just an assumption, so it could be wrong, that due to what had happened there, that they allowed her to break the lease. You'd have to imagine if someone comes in and says, someone got murdered in the apartment below mine, I don't want to live here anymore, that they'd let him out. But she went through it. She didn't just skip town. She went through a process and turned in her notice that she wanted to leave, and then she left. So my guess is no one was paying the rent. And again, I want to circle back to, like, it's really not, like I said, me thinking back to my days, and we're talking in my situation, this is 1998, 1999, so about this time in Colorado, we definitely had units that sat empty for months, because we just had, the complex I worked at, we had I think 700 units, and I would say at any given time, there were 50 that were empty.
Big building.
Yeah, big complex.
Denise says, I know you're winding down, but do you have any intention to look into Craig?
So with Craig, I don't see any evidence indicating that he had any involvement. I think that we're kind of getting into some pretty wild speculation. If we start, you know, I mentioned this last week. I think somebody suggested that maybe it was Jennifer's sister could have had some involvement or something. And, you know, you can try to bend things to try to make it look like somebody might have been involved. But the reality is, we don't have any evidence that Craig's involved. There's no witnesses that's, you know, two things. One, we have four people in the apartment right above it. The wallet's found in that apartment. Everything we have, right? All their stories are changing. All the different issues that we have with them. It seems pretty clear that someone from those apartments was involved. And so then you have these other people, Craig included, who have no connection to the crime scene. No one said that they were at the crime scene. No one said they saw them there. No one suggested they were there. No one suggested they had any beef with Catalina. There's literally nothing to suggest that he had anything to do. The only connection he has is his connection to Jennifer. And so it's, there's nothing, not only is there nothing there to put them even in the same county as the crime scene at the time, but, you know, the same area as the crime scene. But then we also have a pretty clear, I can't tell you who, but I can tell you, I in my opinion, I'm fairly certain someone, at least one someone from that apartment was involved in the murder. So I don't see Craig as a viable suspect. As far as, can I look into him? Yeah. I mean, I look into everybody, but you also have to understand there's some misconceptions about what we can do. Everybody needs to understand that we have some limitations. So we can say, are you going to do a deep dive or look into Craig? But we need to start thinking about practically, what does that look like? I've talked to Craig. I've asked him where he was that day, what he was doing that day, and he told me. We've talked to other witnesses. We have the other witness statements. Like, there's no one has, I wouldn't even know where to go. Like, where else would we go from there to look any further? And that's not, I'm not being a smartass. That's a genuine question too. If somebody has an answer to that, let me know. But it's like, so we have all these witness statements from the people that were there at the time. No one ever saw him there. So like, I wouldn't know who to ask next or what to ask. You know, I know Craig, I've looked at his criminal history. I've spoken to him. I know his involvement with Jennifer and the family. Beyond that, I don't know what else I could do to look any further into Craig. And again, I want to emphasize that there's no indication that I see, there's no evidence in the file that would suggest that he that he would even be a suspect or a person of interest for that matter.
Kathy says, I wonder if there's a way to find out if the police or prosecutor, quote, reminded Truesdale or Medrano where they found the wallet. How many months after finding it was the trial?
So they found it in, I think, May 29th, might have been May 26th, somewhere around the end of May. Trial was in late September. So what is that? June, July, August. So this is about 4 months before the trial. As far, this kind of goes back to what I was saying with, you know, and this is why, you know, I said we're getting to a place where we definitely are kind of needing to start winding things down, is because I'm running out of avenues and places without having Jennifer to speak to. You know, I've contacted all these witnesses. We do have more that I'm working on. I haven't given up on this case by any means, but we're just kind of running out of things to do. So, you know, the question is, what, you know, is there any way to prove if they were reminded by the police, meaning like the police maybe suggested that that's what happened? It's really not. I mean, I guess I could try to track down Medrano, which admittedly I haven't done up to this point. I'd have to have an interpreter because I think he doesn't speak Spanish, if he's still alive and still around, and if I could find him.
It doesn't speak English.
Oh, right. Yeah, it doesn't speak English. So I'd have to have an interpreter. I speak some Spanish. I'm getting better at it through Babbel. but I used to be able to speak Spanish, but not enough to have this kind of conversation. I'd have to have, you know, an interpreter if I could find him, if he's alive. Other than that, I don't know what else. Like I said, I've tried multiple times in multiple ways to get a hold of Truesdale, and he's not talking and won't respond to me. I have like Facebook messages I've sent where I can see that he's read them and hasn't responded. So I don't know. And again, and I won't say that like that's a stretch to think that, because that's certainly, especially knowing what we know, that's something that certainly could be the case. It's something that could have happened. But we just don't have evidence to support that. You know, all we have is, you know, what I broke down on the episode, you know, that Urbano says he found it, left it on the counter and left. Keith walks in a day or two later, finds it, gives it to Cobb. Cobb leaves. Months later, 3 months later, Alan goes looking for it, finds out it's in Cobb's car, gets it, contacts the leasing agent, does all this stuff to find out who the painting company was, calls the painting company. They look up in their records, find out who the actual painter was. He gets a hold of the painter, and the painter tells him, oh, I found it behind the refrigerator coils. And beyond that, I don't know, does it make a bit, you know, what are we looking at here? You know, are we thinking that it wasn't found in that apartment at all? Are we thinking it was hidden somewhere else in the apartment? I think if it was hidden somewhere else, it would be found by I keep going back to my own experiences, but my experiences as a maintenance tech in an apartment place like that, it seemed like it would normally, unless they did still have the furniture and stuff there, like we would go through and move out furniture, clean, fix anything that was broken, you know, so pretty much every inch of the apartment would be gone through. Really, the only place that makes sense for Medrano to find it would be behind the fridge. You know, if he's going to move it out to paint, he's not going to be opening drawers or looking in, you know. That just wouldn't be the case. He would only be moving things that he needs to move to paint.
So you said something that kind of sparked something in me, and I apologize if I'm overstepping my position, but being here, I get to see a lot of things behind the scenes that the listeners don't get to see. And I do know that, you know, the listeners have been kind of asking if you can talk to certain people. And from what I know, you have reached out to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And you have brought to us who you've talked to. So it's not that you're hiding or not trying to contact people. I know you're not willing to say that, but I'm going to say that for you, that I know for a fact that he's reached out to a lot of these people you guys are asking him to talk to.
Yeah, and a lot of, I appreciate that. But yeah, in a lot of different ways, we have a running list of, I mean, anybody you can think of in this case and even peripheral people around them, I've reached out to in one way or another.
And I know that the people that have talked to you, you've brought up on the podcast. So you're not holding anything back.
Yeah. The only one that was held back at all was Cena, because I was waiting to try to get a recorded interview before I shared that. But that was a matter of weeks before it came out. So, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to talk to those people. But when it comes to this, like, yeah, there's no way for me to prove that happened. And I say, like, I'm not going to dismiss it and say it's something that couldn't have happened, that the police, like, led him into that. But I also have to say there's no evidence that that's what happened. And honestly, it makes the most sense to me that a painter, if it was Medrano who found it, that for a painter to find it in that situation, that behind the fridge is one of the few places that makes sense. because everything else should have been gone through by the cleaning people and by the maintenance people. And he's only going to be looking behind things that he needs to paint behind.
Lynn says, many people are suspicious of Keith Truesdale. Have you discovered any reason to deep dive into him as a possible suspect, or can we put this to rest?
It's similar to what I, you know, what I said about Craig and even about this other issue. Like, yeah, I mean, obviously, as I've said multiple times here today, I've made many attempts to talk to Keith. Is there a reason to think he's a suspect? I don't think so. I mean, you have, granted, the police didn't go as far as like interviewing the people that were with him, but in those first few moments, the leasing agents say they saw him with another maintenance guy. They were out, I think, painting fire, doing whatever they were doing with fire extinguishers, you know, coming from the other side of the complex. So it seems like he was working with someone else, you know, unless, I mean, it's the level of conspiracy that would have to be involved there, you know, between what Pam Wiley says and Lavanna says, what all these different people say. There's just, I just don't see any reason to consider him a suspect. Again, unless we're actively trying to push the blame away from the people who were in that apartment. I mean, you know, I'm always open-minded and always, you know, looking for other avenues, but I don't see it with Keith. You know, I whether he was 100% truthful in everything he said, whether he was a shill for the state, you know, if he was trying to, you know, twist things to help their case, I don't know. But him being involved in the crime, I don't see it. And again, I don't know, other than forensic testing, which is what we're really pushing for. Hopefully the Jen's lawyers are going to be doing. You know, that would be the only thing that could connect them, if they can do a full, thorough DNA analysis and compare it to him and somebody else. But I just, you know, I don't see any reason to think he's a suspect.
Kristen says, not a question pertaining to this week, since the wallet seems pretty cut and dry, but I wanted to ask about the DNA. Have you any plans into doing a deeper dive into what was found, and or bringing on an expert to discuss it?
So far, I haven't been able to get my hands on the actual DNA reports. I only have what was reported in the police reports and stated at trial. If I had them, yeah, I'd probably bring someone on, take a look at them, and try to explain them. But you know, that is something that I know Jennifer's attorneys or attorney is working on. You know, look at the DNA that's there and further testing. So that's something that likely will just be handled by her legal team rather than by us. Cause, you know, when I mentioned last week that, you know, we're probably coming up to where we're going to be wrapping this case up. And it's not that we're going to stop investigating it when we stop. I still have other avenues and leads that I'm looking into, but we definitely hit a point where I can do the work that I'm doing, but do I have enough each week to put together a 40 minutes of content in a show that you guys want to listen to? And it's really, and no, the answer is no. You know, we're already, like you heard this week, I had a plan. And then when I get, you know, as I'm researching and find out there's only 10 minutes of content to talk about that. So I put out this other interview in there to make sure that you guys had something. I feel like, again, I felt like it was good and worthwhile to hear, but that's an example. When we get to this point in the case, and without having access to Jennifer too, it's just, I'm not going to waste your time. We're not going to waste my time trying to put together podcast episodes when we don't have the content to do that. So, you know, when it comes to this DNA stuff, you know, if her lawyers are already working on it and we're at a point where if we get to a point where I don't have anywhere else to go with this case, then that'll be something to be left of the lawyers. And of course, we'll always do, if we get new information once we're done with season 10, then we'll always do update episodes and keep coming back to it to keep everybody informed of what's going on.
Kim says, do you think you'll ever be able to speak with Jen? It seems such a shame that the Truth and Justice Army could do so much if we were able to hear her side of the story and answer your questions. Her lawyers are really jeopardizing an incredible potential resource.
One thing I want to make clear is that her lawyer is not doing anything wrong. There was a lot of posts about this on the fan page after last week, with people being pretty negative about her lawyer or Jen's decision not to talk. I want to make one thing very clear. Is it frustrating for me? 100%. Do I think that we could move this investigation further and actually get to the truth and have some finality in this case and maybe find out who actually killed Catalina if we had the opportunity to speak with Jennifer? I do. And that's not to say that she knows who did it, but it's like we have this gaping hole And it's like this obstacle. It's like we have this big river in front of us and we need the bridge to get us to the other side to continue. And Jennifer's that bridge. And without her, it's just a stone wall. We can't get to where we need to go to continue on. So it's super frustrating for me. That being said, it is not uncommon at all for an attorney to tell their client not to talk to the media. There's nothing wrong with it. It's probably a smart thing to do. We've been very lucky in the seasons leading. You know, we've always had access, you know, with through the Innocence Project of Texas or the Exoneration Project in Illinois, you know, the other, every case we've done, we've always had access. You know, with Deb Perringer, COVID kind of, she couldn't use the phone for most of the year last year when we were trying to work on her case before she passed away. We've never dealt with this. We've had lawyers that understand what we can do. They trust us. And trust me, and have gladly opened the door with no restrictions for us to talk to their client. In this case, we don't have that, but that's again, I don't want to confuse my frustration with not being able to speak to Jennifer with that being the wrong thing for her attorney to do. It makes perfect sense that that's what he's doing. That's his right to do it. And it's not, I can't even say that it's a bad decision. I mean, I can say that I think that we could help a lot more. And I think that I really genuinely think that we have probably the best opportunity to help actually find the truth. And it's upsetting that we don't get to, but he's doing what he believes is the right thing to do. And maybe it is. And then when it comes to Jennifer, people say, well, that's her attorney saying that. Well, Jennifer could still talk too. I would never, ever, ever advise someone to do something other than what their attorney's telling them to do. Like that would be the dumbest thing Jennifer could ever do is when she has an attorney who's working pro bono and working his ass off in this case for her. If she were to say, you know what, I'm not going to listen to you and I'm going to go ahead and do this podcast anyway, that would be a terrible, terrible decision. So I 100% respect her decision to follow her attorney's advice when it comes to that. So that being said, I'm going to, by the time you hear this, it will have already been done, but I've reached a point now where our research team has developed some great cases. I'll talk to you guys about a little bit at the end of the episode here. We are ready to move forward, very soon. And so I'm going to be, by the time you hear this, I will have already done so, sending a message to Jennifer's attorney and to the family to let them know that we respect the decision, but if we cannot have contact with Jennifer, if we cannot interview her to get her version of the story, then we're going to have to bow out of this investigation and leave it to them and wish them all the best in moving forward. But there's just nothing else that we can do without having that access. So that will be sent out to them. So who knows? Maybe they'll hear that and decide that they want to go and let her be interviewed. That would be great. And if not, then we're going to, like I said, be tying up some loose ends and we just onward and upward. You know, we got to keep pushing forward. And one thing I do want to make clear too, I think that the words I chose in the last episode where I said, you know, if she doesn't want to, you know, if their attorney's not going to let her come on the show, then we're going to find somebody who wants to help themselves. I don't remember that's exactly what I said, but I think it was somewhere around the lawns, and I want to make sure I correct that I do not think this is Jennifer not wanting to help herself if what she's doing is listening to her attorney instead of listening to a random podcaster. You know, that again, that's the right decision for her if that's what her attorney's telling her to do. If that's what he's telling her to do, then that's what she needs to do. So I don't think that, but at the same time, we've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases of people that are begging to be a part of this and that are begging for our help. We have cases that have been submitted by attorneys asking us to help with these cases. And it's just to a point where I don't want to waste any more effort if we're never going to be able to get over that bridge to get to the other side to get her, you know, again, the huge missing piece of her version of events. So I'll keep you guys posted on that, but that's kind of where we're looking at going forward as far as speaking with Jennifer. The last I talked to Justin, her attorney, he told me, he's like, I just don't think I'm going to be able to help you with her, you know, having her talk to you. And he just said he still got so many things he's working on, and he didn't think that was going to be in the cards. But it's been about a month since we've had that conversation, so I'm going to circle back to it, and we'll see what he says.
Gretchen says, I don't want this to seem like I'm just part of the I Hate Bob Ruff group. I love the show and even this season, but Bob, you just phoned this episode in. I feel like I had some real questions and you didn't do any investigation. You just reread what was already in the record. The fan page has been talking about this for a while and you just dismissed us and it. That being said, loved the episode on The Voice. Very helpful.
For starters, I would say if you have real questions, like this is the place for that. I wish you would have asked that, whatever those questions were here. So, because I don't know what those questions are. I mean, yeah, I appreciate the feedback, but look at this specific question from my perspective, or this comment that I just mailed in the episode. There was so much more I could have done with the wallet, and I had specific questions. But if you don't ask me the questions, I don't know. All I can do is look at the case and investigate it the way I feel they need to be investigated. Now the fact that you got an episode that was, half the episode was an interview that I had already conducted. Yeah, that's certainly see your point there. I didn't create anything new for the second half of that. As I said, I've mentioned a couple times already, I'm pretty handcuffed by it. I don't agree that I mailed in the investigation into the wallet. There's just nothing there. And what I was hoping was in this episode, if there was, so look again from my perspective here, there's all these listeners that listened and I don't know of any, but I'm sure there's more than just Gretchen that thought there was more to the wallet, but nobody's giving me that feedback. No one has reached out to me and said, well, what about this? Or I think this, so that's I would strongly disagree that I mailed. I spent 2 whole days digging through every and searching through everything from the DA's file to the police file to the trial transcripts, cross-referencing everything. And then when I came up at the end of the day, that's all there is. The fact that no one talked to Urbano until Alan did. So the whole couch thing came up just out of whole cloth. There's no way to, and I've reached out to Cobb and he won't answer me. I've reached out to Keith Truesdale and he won't answer me. There's really nothing else more I can do with it. And that kind of speaks to what I was just talking about a minute ago. That this gets, I will tell you this from a production standpoint, this part of not all seasons, because most seasons, we have a place where we can see where we're going. But we've been operating this entire season under the pretense that pretty soon we'll be able to talk to Jennifer. Pretty soon we're going to be able to, once they get the case file, once this happens, we'll be able to actually speak to Jennifer and get her side of the story and get her version of events, be able to piece it together. And then it's like now all of a sudden here we come towards the end of it and there's nothing to do. So again, from a production standpoint, we have deadlines, we have contractual obligations, we have things. So here I am. I mean, what time was it? 3:00 on Thursday I texted you, Mike, last week?
Yeah.
Yeah. And keep in mind, the episodes have to be out the door to Mike by Friday morning so that he can edit them and get them out the door to Shane by midday Friday for us to get these episodes done. And it was at 3:00 when I finally finished everything on the writing for the wallet segment that I realized like this is not an episode, and that's the 100% transparent how this process worked last week was when I got done I realized I've got 10 minutes tops, and so what do we do? I can't put out a 10-minute episode. We got to put something out. So I tried to find what I thought would be the best possible thing, the most relevant information I could put out, which was that interview with Laura Nyreiter. So I'm sorry you felt that I was mailing in, but just so you know, gave it everything I got. Unless somebody can tell me there's something more there other than just speculation, there's nothing. Again, this goes, and I said this earlier too, there's a lot of that, you should do this, or there's a lot of you should do more about, when I think that a lot of times, a lot of you that are listening don't haven't thought about what the limitations are that we have when it comes down to, a 25-year-old case with, we only have witness statements and we've reached the point in the season 26 weeks in, we're half a year now, we're 6 months into it where now we've run out of the people to talk to. There's just not much more I can do than what I'm doing for you.
Well, I can ask you my questions with the wallet, but I know the answers, and not because I know anything different, just because we don't know the answers. But the biggest questions for the wallet for me are, how did it get there?
Right.
We don't know. No one wants to talk. So
right.
We don't know. Why was it there? We don't know. Was there DNA on it? Well, yeah, there's DNA on it. But as you just said earlier, you don't have any reports.
Well, they never did a DNA test on the wallet. They did. Okay. They tested for fingerprints, and there were no fingerprints on it. No usable fingerprints.
So those are some of my biggest questions, right. But we can't – I don't see a way to answer those either.
Yeah.
Like, I do have questions about the wallet, but yeah. I know that there is no answer for them.
Yeah, we all do. And so I guess what I want to tell you is if you if you think you're the only one frustrated about where we're at with this case right now, I just want you to know you're not. Like, this is – I am extreme – and Mike and Zach have heard me venting some of these frustrations. Like, it's just – it's killing me because I feel like we're right there. If we – I feel like we could solve this case. I feel like we can actually get names and people, and we can get this thing put together. And I just feel like we're handcuffed. And so, like I said, there are things, and then, you know, there's these ethical issues that come up. Like, yes, are there leads that I'm trying to work on right now? 100%. Can I blurt them out on the air right now? Absolutely not. I can't. And some, you know, for some of them, it's like, oh, I need to take this. This needs to go to the attorneys and needs to file a certain path. In other ones, it's like, well, I'm not taking this person's name and throwing it out when I don't know if there's any reason for it to be thrown out there yet. And so there is, you know, I think somebody had worded it somewhere along the way. I mean, that I'm giving up on this case. Somebody on the fan page that you don't give up so soon. I'm not giving up on the case. I'm just saying it's just reaching a point where we can't continue to make episodes about the case much longer.
Jason says, are you now against police lying during interrogations? If I recall correctly, a couple years ago, you defended this tactic quite vigorously on one of your spinoff podcasts. If your stance has changed, why?
No, it's a good question and relevant to what Laura Nyreiter just talked about. If you didn't listen to the episode, she was a big part of, in the state of Illinois, getting legislation passed through that makes it illegal for the police to lie to juvenile suspects during interrogations. And I don't think, Jason, I don't think it was a spinoff podcast. I think it was this podcast when we had that conversation. My position on it was that I could see that there's another side to it as far as being able to lie to a suspect, that it's hard to draw a line. If I was king of the world and got to make a decision, can police lie to suspects? I would say no. And has that opinion developed more since a few years ago when we had this conversation? Sure, it has. But I'm just always one of these. For anybody that has listened to any spinoff podcast or anything, you know that I'm about as neutral as they come. I'm politically independent and neutral, and I'm always trying to see everything from both sides. Is how I try to just operate my life, and that was just a conversation that had come up, and I got to thinking about it. It was like, but man, if we said they can never lie, like where's that line drawn? You know, when police are trying, you know, when they're interviewing somebody who's guilty and they're trying to get information out of them, you know, if they were to say some little white lies about, like, you know, someone saw you walking down the street, so how can you say you weren't there? Where a police might say something like that in hopes to get, you know, and they're trying to see the reaction out of you to see if you're like, that's bullshit, I wasn't on the street, or if immediately you start changing your stories. Since then, I've got to understand the psychology a little bit better of what interviews and interrogations do to you mentally and break you down. And so now I a little better understand the fact that even though I could say, like, you know, I think back then I used the example of, well, if my kid was missing and someone had kidnapped them and I'm trying to find out where my son is, then yeah, where, you know, it's put yourself in that position. I'm sure there are parents out there that are good people that would never condone this, that would say, yeah, waterboard the son of a bitch until he tells you where my kid's at. But that's not, you know, you don't legislate like that based on your own anecdotal, imaginary, emotional scenarios. But that was kind of where the place that I was coming from back then, that, yeah, if it was my kid, I want you to do what you got to do to find him. And so that was me looking at it from the other perspective. But again, like, now I've just seen so much. I've learned a lot more since then. And so, yeah, I guess my stance now would be I disagree with the Supreme Court ruling. I don't think they should be able to lie. I do think that probably can, along the lines, if that gets thrown out, maybe cost some people their lives, that there maybe are a few instances where by the police bending the truth a little bit, they might be able to get somebody to break and tell the truth and maybe, you know, bring somebody to justice or find somebody that's missing or something like that. But at the end of the day, it's not worth the possibility of convicting people that are innocent and maybe finally getting justice for those crimes, only to later find out you got the wrong person and you never really did get justice. So I know that's a long-winded response, but I've had to kind of think it through as we were talking. But no, I think that was on here. And so, yeah, I guess the short answer is the TLDR is, yeah, I guess my stance has changed. And I think, yeah, it should just be a blanket policy that you just shouldn't be able to lie, period.
Matthew says, before we give up on this case, is there any way for us to submit questions for Jennifer through her attorney?
I don't know. That's something that I will, in my correspondence with the attorney this week, as I said, I'm going to reach out to him and let him know where we're at with things. I can ask that. And certainly if he's willing to do that, I'll put it out there. For me personally, I don't think that's going to get us where we needed to go. You know what I mean? If you have something filtered through an attorney and just very direct, you can't assess somebody's truthfulness and credibility and thing through that format. I would like to have a conversation. It's not that I want to interrogate Jennifer. I think it's been pretty clear that my position on Jennifer right now is that I don't think she's guilty. I personally don't think she actually knows what happened in the crime. I think she could possibly know something. Like, she could know who she thinks did it, but maybe doesn't have the exact details. But I don't think that she was a lookout, and I don't think that she was actually involved in the crime itself. But I still would want to have a flowing conversation with her and be able to ask some questions.
Yeah, honestly, at this point, as a listener, I don't really need to hear her opinion of the case. I would just like to hear her story.
Right.
From her point of view. And that's all I would like to hear from her, is just to hear what she has to say. Like, where was she? You know, tell her story.
Exactly.
And let's hear that.
Yeah. What I want to do is say, tell me what actually happened. Not the lies, not the story she told the police. Tell me what actually happened that morning. When you got up, where did you go? What did you do? What did you see? What do you know? That's the only question that I want to have. I want to have her tell that story. And if she can, great. If she can't, then, you know, we just, like I said, we need to move on. And with that, I do want to let you guys know where we're at moving forward. This episode's kind of a bummer. I'm sorry, guys. I didn't mean to. But hey, you guys asked the bummer questions. Kind of led us here. But anyway, there is a lot of positive. I want to tell you that I'm super excited moving forward. Our research team has just done a phenomenal, amazing job with the case. They filtered through over 300 cases in the last 6 weeks, and they've gone through a very thorough process. It was presented to me over 3 hours last night or yesterday afternoon, and they narrowed the cases down and narrowed them down to where they got to about four of them. They pitched me four yesterday. Two of them I like a lot. Two of them I don't think are going to work. And then there's a fifth one that came out that it's actually has some connection to this case. Sort of, wouldn't work for a long season of Truth and Justice, because there's just not enough there. And so nothing is set in stone right now, but just to keep you guys informed of where I think we're going forward. Essentially, we have three cases that I'm looking at right now. One of them is a really super interesting. It's the one I'm the most interested in. It would be a long form, normal season of Truth and Justice. And it's fascinating, and I definitely think that it's looking like it's a wrongful conviction. And then we have another one that also looks, it's a very interesting case, looks like it's a wrongful conviction, but I don't know that there's a full season there. And then the one that has the connection to this case that definitely would be more of like a George Powell type season, a very short kind of mini season. So kind of what I'm messing around with or playing around with the idea of right now is, while we're developing the full season, that we may have one or possibly two short seasons in between. So we may do the mini season on the case that has some connection to Jennifer's, and then from that would be season 11. You know, and when I say mini, that might be 4 to 6 episodes, and then do another smaller season after that with another one of the cases that's great. But again, I don't think there's 6 months worth of content there. So we may do, you know, season 12, maybe another short mini season that would be maybe 10 or 12 episodes. And then after that, moving into season 13 would be a long one. So kind of more the format that Undisclosed usually does, where they do a long season and then Colin does some short seasons in between. Looking at possibly going that direction, partially just for production reasons, because this one I want to really fully develop before we're and do a lot of research and get a lot of documents and do interviews before we're ready to put it out there. And partially because as they brought these cases to me, these other two cases, they're just, man, like, I hate to not have their stories told just because they don't have 20 episodes worth of content, because these are people that really do need our help and certainly could use the exposure. And again, I think one of them was submitted to us by the person's attorney who's asking us for our help and asking us to help tell the story. So nothing set in stone right now, but before too long, we're going to be moving on to another season. That's kind of looks like the direction we're going to go. I'm pretty excited about it, about all three of these cases. And I want to thank you guys for hanging out through this one. I mean, to me, this season's been fascinating. These last few weeks are just starting to be a struggle. But for those of you that have been with us for a long time, you know that we tend to have a little struggle once you get to the end of the season anyway. But we've got a lot more to do. This week's episode, based on some listener requests, I'm going to be breaking down the full investigation into Ernest and Tim, the two accomplices that Jennifer named in her confession. A listener brought to my attention that I've always said they never really tried looking for the actual killers when there is quite a bit of information in the report. So we're going to be going through that. Everything that Swainson and Alan did to try to find Jennifer's accomplices. That's going to be this week's episode. And then we'll see where we go from there. But again, thanks for sticking with us. Make sure you tune in on Sunday. We appreciate you guys. Love you guys. We'll talk to you next week. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Produced and edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show was created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by Zach Weaver, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Charlena White, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Edith Swanneck, Lindsay Pease, Erica Cantor, and Jen Reese Incandela. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd really like to support us, you can do so in a number of ways. To financially support the show, you can go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. On the Patreon page, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we also have reward levels on Patreon that include access to behind-the-scenes videos of the tapings of our Friday follow-up episodes, ad-free versions of all of our episodes, Truth and Justice Army t-shirts and hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the companies that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, Truth and Justice Pod. Just click the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in the investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Mike can be found at Murb Gaming, MURRBGAMING, and Zach is at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, and tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice. And so, yeah, I guess the short answer is the TLDR is, yeah, I guess my stance has changed. And I think, yeah, it should just be a blanket policy that you just shouldn't be able to lie, period.
TLDR, that means too long, don't read.
Too long,
didn't read.
Right.
Okay. I was like, what did you just say?
Thanks for having my back,
Mike. Not a problem. I'm glad you had that because I was that was literally my next question was like, what?
Yeah. The problem is you're supposed to put the TLDR at the beginning.
Oh.
So if it's too long to want to read, this is what I said.